Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Mike Radencich, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tying the classic salmon fly. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc. Doing Business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Mike Radencich about tying the classic salmon fly. Whether you tie flies as a hobby or a profession, and no matter what your degree of perfectionism, fly tying becomes much more enjoyable and efficient with the proper tools. Wasatch tools are rugged yet beautifully crafted tools featuring Cocobolo handles and 24-karat gold accents that fit nicely in the hand and are smooth to the touch. Manufactured in the United States from the best materials available, all tools are unconditionally guaranteed for your lifetime. If you ever have a problem with a Wasatch tool, just return it to our factory in Albany, Oregon, and we'll replace it, no questions asked. To find out more about Wasatch tools, visit www.flytyingtools.com. That's www.flytyingtools.com. Well, before we introduce Mike, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Mike's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Mike's book, Tying the Classic Salmon Fly, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And if you'd like to find out more about Stackpole and what they have to offer, go to www.stackpolebooks.com. That's www.stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win Mike's book, Tying the Classic Salmon Fly. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Mike's beautiful book. Tonight, our guest is Mike Radencich. Mike's interest in tying classic salmon flies started when he was about 20 years old. Along the way, he picked up a number of fly tying books, but Joe Bates' book, The Art of the Atlantic Salmon Fly, was one of his favorites. There was one tier in Bates' book that really interested him, and that was Ron Alcott, who lived in Groton, Connecticut. Mike made contact with Ron and ended up spending a weekend at his house tying and learning. Ron was a great teacher, and he revealed to Mike much about tying the classics, most of which he uses today. As 1990 progressed, he immersed himself ever deeper into the world of salmon tying, fly tying, acquainting himself with many of the best-known tires in the U.S., purchasing materials, collecting rare 19th-century books on the subject as well. And at that time, he met with Judith Dunham, who had just published her seminal work on the salmon fly titled The Atlantic Salmon Fly. It was her book that inspired Mike to consider producing his own book on the salmon fly. During 1991, the book actually began to take shape as he traveled from coast to coast to photograph Wayne Llewellyn, Bob Berbeka, and Mark Waslick for chapters on salmon fly tying techniques, and then later to visit Darwin Atkin in California for a chapter on netting and framing flies, as well as Gene Sunday in Flint, Michigan for a hook-making chapter. Tying the Classic Salmon Fly was published in 1997 by Stackpole Books. His second book, Classic Salmon Fly Materials, went to press in 2006 after just a year's worth of work. Mike's third book, 20 Salmon Flies, was published by Stackpole and released in December of 2009. His latest book, Classic Salmon Fly Patterns, is still in production and should be released in August of 2012 by Stackpole. Well, Mike, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Excellent.
Ready to answer just a ton of questions here?
Sounds good to me. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning. How's that? It's always a good place to start. And
absolutely.
I always like a little bit of history to go mm-hmm. along with whatever we're doing today. And so, you know, this is the art of fly fishing for Atlantic salmon goes way back. When did it all start, and when were flies actually used for salmon fishing?
Well, a little bit of that is obviously a historical perspective. I'm not particularly a historian, but I've done enough reading and perusing some of the old classic books on the subject, and it seems to me that it was around the turn of the 19th century, around 1800, they were tying salmon flies at that time. And there was a book that I found called, Rural Sports, that featured, I think it was the first hand-colored plate of salmon flies. So it goes back at least to 1800 and probably much farther back.
Wow, yeah. Now, what about at some form it turned from, you know, functional flies to
mm-hmm.
more the art form, and I'm not saying, and you can clarify this too as to whether the ones that are artistically tied are also functional, but
sure.
At some point it turned into an actual art form. When did that start happening?
Well, the salmon fly really evolved as anything does, you know, over time, but I think it really came into flower during the middle to the late Victorian era. That's around the time of George Kelson, who was really the real aficionado, or the real, I can't think of the word, but he really brought it to the fore. And I really think around that time, about 1895, is when it became really an art form. And there was another fly tire right around that time named John Traherne, who his flies, there's about 20 patterns that he originated, and I personally find it hard to believe that he actually fished those flies, because they really were artistic. And I really think around that time, about 1890, 95, is when it really became a true art form.
And
that's kind of a guess on my part, but just seeing it. During most of the Victorian era, I think a lot of the fly tires considered it an art form, but it really was a utilitarian thing to do, you know, throw the fly in the water and catch fish. But I really think that the latter part of the Victorian era is when it became an art form.
And in today's world, they're really two separate
yes,
results,
I would definitely say so, yeah.
Yeah, too much work goes into that.
Well, what I mean,
the ones
yeah.
you tied, throw them in the
well,
water.
The thing is, there are a number of fly tires that exclusively tie salmon flies as an art form, and really their flies are, a lot of people derisively call them feather art, which to me is not really a fair name for it. But it's just like anything, any kind of form of art evolves, and one of the things that I always try to teach when I talk to people about salmon flies is still don't forget the roots of the salmon fly and that what they were originally used for, so mm-hmm. which was
so,
to catch fish.
Right, exactly. Now, what got you started in tying salmon flies? I know you do have a little bit of an art background, so that must have attracted
yep.
you
yep.
at some point. But what got you going on this?
Well, it's kind of a funny thing. You mentioned in the introduction that I was 20 years old when I started tying flies. I really started tying trout flies around that time when I was in college. But there was one book, Herder's Manual Fly Tying, that in the back of that book there were a couple plates of salmon flies, fully dressed salmon flies. And these weren't photographs. They were just painted plates. And I was really drawn to those, and not really considering that I'd ever tie them, but that those two plates just for some reason stuck in my mind for a long, long time. And then around 1989, I kind of strayed away from trout fly tying and fishing for a while. And then in 89, I kind of got back to it, and I started tying a lot of trout flies. But I had a book by Paul Jorgensen that a lot of fly tiers are familiar with, Tying the Classic Salmon Fly, or The Classic Salmon Fly. And that sort of got my interest in high gear about it, and that's really when I started tying the salmon fly.
And prior to that, you were tying trout flies to go
really
fishing.
Really, primarily,
right?
Yep. Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously, when you probably first looked at it, you didn't start to do it to make money, right?
Even back then, because I am a bit of an artist, and I think it was just the combination of colors and textures that really drew me to it. And I really, from that point, I even considered it more of an art form than a utilitarian thing. And although I'll tie a fly or two that it would be considered feather art, I still tend to tie the classics. I just like the looks of them.
Right, so. Right. Since you started tying flies for art purposes, has it helped you with your tying of flies to fish?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. People ask me that all the time because, to be honest with you, I don't tie anything else nowadays. The only kind of fly I tie is a salmon fly. And so that's I guess you could say
very specific,
I really dedicated myself to that genre of fly tying. Totally.
When looking at your book and going through some of the tying methods, just right off the bat, I could see that, wow, these are some good tips and techniques that could be applied, you know, in everyday
absolutely.
Tying of fishing flies. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about equipment, first of all. Is there any kind of a special vise you use? If so, what do you prefer?
Well, I use a rotating type of vise, and I primarily now I use a vise that's fairly new, I'd say within the past couple of years, called the J vise. And I used for a long time I used a Renzetti vise, the Master vise, which is a beautiful vise, and I really enjoy tying with it. But for a salmon fly tire, there is one aspect of it that I needed something a little bit different, and it's hard to describe it, you know, in a radio interview. I have to show it in actual practice. But the J vise has a gooseneck, I guess you could call it, where you've got the rotating part of the vise, and then it kind of curves down and then comes back up to the actual jaws of the vise, and that allows me to put my hand right there to hold onto the wing when I tie on the wing, and that just makes things so much easier. I doubt if it was made specifically for salmon flies, but it sure works very well for that. So.
Okay. What other equipment would you recommend one have before they get started tying salmon flies?
Along with the vise, that's obviously the most important thing, and I would really recommend whatever vise the tire gets, it is good to have a rotating style type of vise, and it can either be a pedestal vise or a clamp type vise, clamps to the table. I like the pedestal vise because I can move it around. Then along with the vise, you'll need a pair of fine tip scissors, and I use two or three, and depending on what I'm using it for. A shepherd's hook or a bodkin is very important because I use that a lot for tying in the fur bodies. And then, let's see, fine flat nose pliers without any kind of serration on the inside of the nose itself. They've got to be absolutely flat and clean. And
what do you use those for specifically?
Those are used for a number of things. A lot of times you're going to want you'll have a feather, especially in full feather wing flies, where you're going to want to flatten the rachis. And when I say rachis, I'm going to use that term a lot. That's actually the stem of the feather. And I'll kind of get into that a little bit of real quick feather anatomy later on. But that's really a good thing to have. And
okay.
Let's see, I'm just trying to think what else. That's pretty much it. I do use a small rubber-tipped pair of hackle pliers for various things, especially when I fold hackles. I use it for that and also for wrapping throats.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's, I'm just trying to think what else I use. That's, oh yes, the other important thing is a burnishing tool, and that's either, it can be something that you can buy from Wasatch, which you mentioned earlier. They have a whole assortment of burnishing tools that can be used, or you can use a clay modeling tool. And the burnishing tool is used for burnishing silk bodies, either silk tags or silk bodies.
Hmm.
The last step that you would use in building a silk body.
Okay.
And what that does, it helps to smooth out the silk.
Okay.
And
what go ahead.
I was just going to say, I should mention that for wrapping silk, it's a real priority to wear silk gloves. Very important.
Hmm.
So, and the reason
otherwise,
that is,
do you hook your rough fingers onto the silk? Or
yeah,
something?
It's very easy to, and also the oil from your fingertips can mar the silk, especially light colored silks. So that's almost an absolute. You've got to have a pair of white silk gloves. Usually, and you can find those like at Cabela's or someplace like that, or just go on the web and type in silk gloves, and you'll find them. So.
And what do you wear those from start to finish? Or?
Oh, no, just when wrapping silk.
Oh, just when wrapping silk. Okay.
Just for wrapping silk, exactly. That's
so you don't worry about oils and so forth on the other feathers? And
Nope, not at all.
Okay.
Let me stop you for a second and tell you that it would be very, very hard to tie in a fully dressed wing on a salmon fly with a wearing silk gloves. It just couldn't be done.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
No, I just thought I'd throw that in, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Well, I was concerned, you know, because we're building artwork here, and I know you and I both come from a photographic background and thinking about archival, you know, materials and so forth. And so I just got to thinking, well, I wonder if, you know, oils and stuff are, of course, I guess feathers have enough oil in them.
Well, I was just going to say that. Yeah, that's actually an inherent property of especially waterfowl feathers. You know, they are, which can cause a problem when dyeing these feathers. You have to degrease them or get the oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a, that's really not a worry at all. So.
Okay. What about magnification?
Magnification. That's actually another good point. My eyes, I'm pretty much nearsighted, so for me, for the most part, I don't need magnification, but sometimes I do use a magnifying hood, mainly for trimming the head on the fly, and also wrapping tips and tags. Sometimes, most of the time I don't, but it's not a bad idea to have it. A lot of fly tires use the magnifying hood for that purpose. So.
Okay, let's time to take a quick break, and then when we come back, Mike, we'll dig into more about materials and talk about that. So when we return, we'll be talking with Mike about tying the classic salmon fly. Okay. I just heard a click. I want to make sure I'm still on here. You can hear me, Mike?
Yep.
Okay. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Mike Radenich about tying the classic salmon fly. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Mike, let's talk about materials. We already dug in here a little bit, but what are some of the materials that the average fly tyer wouldn't have in their box that they would need to get familiar with or need to buy?
That's a good question.
Is that a long list?
There's actually quite a few of those, to be quite honest. I'm going to start from the tail and work toward the head. I think that's going to be the easiest way. The most important feather that a tyer can have or should have, and they really need to find a vendor who knows how to high grade the feathers. And what I mean by that is selecting the very best, and that's toppings. What I mean by toppings, those are the crests or the golden yellow feathers on the top of a golden pheasant head. The toppings are absolutely critical for a really fine-looking salmon fly, because toppings are used, I would say, about 80% of the time in the tails of the salmon fly, and probably about that much on the top of the wing. That's why it's also called a topping. So the golden pheasant crest is paramount importance. Then I'm just trying to think. There are so many different feathers. There's what we call speckled galena. Well, actually, I'm getting up toward the throat, but sometimes galena or guinea fowl can be used on it as a tail veiling. There are a lot of exotic feathers like toucan, Indian crow, blue chatter, and I really won't get into those right now because the problem there is that so many patterns call for those particular kind of feathers, and most of the time those feathers are very, very difficult to find because they tend to be rare, so we use substitutes. So kingfisher, the blue kingfisher as a substitute, can be used for the blue chatterer on the sides or a tail veiling. Gosh, there's toucan. Toucan is a very fine feather. That a perfect substitute for that is cul de canard, dyed a very light yellow. And there's so many feathers. There's teal sides. There's wood duck. Sometimes we call it summer duck. For wing horns that a lot of flies have, we use blue and gold macaw or scarlet macaw. There's Cory bustard, which is can be substituted with turkey, mottled spotted turkey. Then there's Florican bustard, which is a different kind of bustard, and that you'll have to find. There are people out there who make substitutes for that. And it's hard to describe a lot of these feathers without actually showing them, you know.
Sure. Well, already you've given me a picture of, like, a lot of that I don't have, and I've got thousands of dollars worth of stuff in my fly tying area here.
Well, maybe I can tell you the easiest feathers to obtain would be turkey, goose, dyed goose. Again, these are feathers for the wings and underwings. And then the golden pheasant tail, peacock wing quills are pretty easy to find. So, because a lot of wings call for peacock, and there are many, many other materials, but those are some of the staples, I guess you could call.
Right.
Then
right.
There, of course, those are the feathers. Then we can talk about furs and tinsels and there's. I mean, I should tell everybody that, especially those who might not be familiar with tying the classic salmon fly, a typical fully dressed salmon fly can have as many as 50 different elements on the fly.
Wow.
You tie it in. So it's
now, the tinsels and the silk thread and so forth, would that be the same tinsels and and thread that we might have or use now?
Yeah, we salmon fly tires, especially those of us who really get into it, we tend not to use Mylar tinsels. We use gold, or it's not real gold, but metal tinsels, like gold tinsel and silver tinsel, flat tinsels, and then there are the oval, silver and oval gold tinsels in different thicknesses, fine, medium, and large. Then there is a tinsel called twist, which is, and the difference between oval tinsel and twist is that twist has a round profile, whereas oval tinsel has, well, an oval profile. And then there's a tinsel called lace, which is three very fine lengths of twisted together to make a kind of a, I don't know how to describe it, a gnarly or knurled kind of tinsel. It's really actually quite beautiful when you wrap it onto a fly. Then there are the embossed tinsels, so which are essentially a flat tinsels that have an embossing all along the length. So that's pretty much the tinsels. Then there are the silks, and we tend to use the Japanese embroidery silks because they come on a thin, narrow tube, about half an inch in diameter, and they're flat already. They're really wonderful silks to use. So, and they come in many, many different colors. And then there are the furs. There's mohair, there's seal fur, or seal X, which is a substitute for seal fur, which are probably the two most, mohair and seal fur are probably the two most used types of furs, and sometimes for wool, we use wool on the bodies or also on the butts of the flies. I mean, I could spend literally 2 to 3 hours just talking about materials.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up a second here, and
sure.
When one wants to tie a salmon fly,
mm-hmm.
where do you start? Do you start with, you know, like I know you've got patterns in the book that I have, Tying the Classic Salmon Fly. You've got many different patterns in here, and
yep.
The recipes for those and how to tie them and so forth. But and some of them come from specific people
mm-hmm.
in the past. Are there, you know, when you're starting out doing this, do you pick a pattern, and are there many different standard patterns, or do many of these people get creative and create their own designs?
Well,
how does that work?
Yeah, it's not like just sitting down one day and say, okay, I'm going to start tying salmon flies. It's far more, how do I say, I don't want to use the word complicated than that, but it's, first of all, without question, that anyone who wants to start tying the classics must have at least a year of experience tying trout flies or any other kind of flies. That's
sure.
an absolute must, because there are so many techniques that are used in tying salmon flies that you've got to have a base to start with.
Right.
Secondly, I would highly recommend that a student or someone who wants to really learn to tie the salmon flies is either seek out a well-established salmon fly tier and spend a couple days with him or her, or take a class from a salmon fly tier. And I kind of go back to my own experience. That's what I did. I got very frustrated when I first started trying to tie myself from a book. It's far much, much easier to learn, a much faster learning arc, I guess you could say, if you're sitting in front of a master and watching him or her tie, and especially a good teacher, because then you'll come away with a much greater grounding on how to tie the classics. It really isn't something for the beginner fly tier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have a question came in on the internet, Ed in Templeton, and he says, Mike, do you ever offer clinics or classes?
I do. Yeah, I do. In fact, I have a guy coming this weekend. He's a Russian, young Russian man named Yuri, and he's going to be here for the weekend. and it's just going to be me and him, basically.
Oh, wow.
I'm finding that more and more people are really interested in doing this, which is, you know, a good thing for them because they really come away, again, this is what I'm talking about, with a well-grounded base from which to start. So yes, I do that. And I also give classes. I was in Seattle and in Albany, Oregon in March, and I did a two-day class up in Seattle and then a two-day class down at the show, and the fly tying show in Albany. And that's another good way to begin.
Right, right. Now, I forgot to, I usually ask my guests after the first break, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world. And I know you're working on a new book, or you finished it, right? I mean,
it's very close to production. It'll be out in this August, just a few months from now. So,
and tell us about that book. What it's going to contain?
Yeah, it really is sort of I guess you could say a culmination of a series. The series that I've been working on, starting with Tying the Classic Salmon Fly, and this book is Classic Salmon Fly Patterns, which essentially will be a pattern Bible for anyone who wants to really dive into the world of the classic salmon fly. And there will be a little over 1,700 patterns in the book. And I was able to employ 86 fly tiers from all around the world, 17 countries, to tie about, I think I have over 900 photographs of selected flies from the 1,700 that will be in the book. So it's going to be quite a compendium of salmon fly patterns. And at the end of the book, there will be a chapter on modern salmon flies for the artistic at heart, which is kind of what we were talking about earlier. So
yeah, so when you're talking about that, modern flies, are you talking about diverging from the classic patterns and creating your own? Yeah.
Oh yes.
Okay.
You'll see some flies in there that are quite. You can still get the idea that okay, this is a salmon fly, but it's quite a step away from the classic type pattern. So.
Okay. And if people wanted to keep track of you and find out what you're up to and find about your books and your classes and so forth, where can they find you?
I have a website, and it's titled, you can find it at www.radencichsalmonflies.com. So RADENCICH, salmonflies, FLIES.com.
Okay.
And there's information there about the books and also the classes that I give and also just a bunch of other stuff. So.
Yeah, and if I don't...
I'm sorry?
I'm checking real quick here to see if we've put a link on your page to your site. If we haven't, I'll do that right after the show here, but I just want to...
Okay.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, yeah.
Good. Okay.
So if you didn't get that, just go to Mike's speaker's page on our site, and we have the link that take you right to his site. So great. Okay, we roundabout answered my question, which was... that there are classic patterns that one would want to duplicate to learn from. And
mm-hmm.
then once you basically feel comfortable with that and understand those and have practiced, then you might even diverge further and do your own thing. Now, are there going back to the materials and so forth that we were talking about, and a lot of those I'm not familiar with and don't use or never have used, is there... specific sources that you go to that just have materials for salmon flies,
Yes, actually, the best source right now is by a gentleman named John McLean in Michigan, and his website is www.feathersmc. That's as in Mike Charlie. com. So feathersmc.com. And he carries all the feathers that a fly tier needs. Sometimes he carries some rare feathers, but not always. But he always does carry substitutes for the rare feathers like the kingfisher and a substitute for Indian crow and so on and so forth. Now, there are other sources. There is, I think it's called Creekside Fly Fishing in Oregon. Rich Youngers, he has a lot of really, really good salmon fly tying materials. If you want, what I can do is compile a list of sources for you and send that over to you so you can put it on the website.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Would that be helpful?
Sure, yeah.
Because
I'm not sure people...
Well, I was just going to say, it's not just the feathers and furs, but also hooks.
Right, which I want to talk about next. There is a question here. But since we've been talking about feathers quite a bit, let's continue on with that for a few minutes.
Sure.
Jim in California wrote in and said, why is it so hard to find jungle cock and other materials here in the U.S. when they are readily available in the U.K.?
That's actually a question I'm not sure I can answer, because I think it's just different laws governing trade in exotic feathers.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, I'm surprised that you can get jungle cock in the UK, because I've been told by a number of fly tiers in the UK that they can't get jungle cock, that they actually have to try and get it from the United States or other sources.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's tough. Jungle cock is a tough.
Is it an endangered species, jungle cock?
No, jungle cocks aren't endangered, but I believe they are a CITES listed bird. And CITES is the Convention
mm-hmm.
on International Trade of Endangered Species. And there are CITES 1, CITES 2, and CITES 3. And some of these birds are on the CITES 1 list, which means that it's not illegal to possess them, but it is illegal to engage in international trade of some of these. When you get up into the CITES 3 list, I hope I'm saying this right, but I believe that's the list where it's illegal to even possess some of the
mm-hmm.
the birds or some of the feathers. So
I know this has to do a lot with orchid trade as well.
Absolutely.
Orchids, yeah,
absolutely.
Same kind of thing.
A real
yeah.
good example, and let me just bring this up, that a real good example of a feather, type of feather that's called for in a number of classic salmon patterns, but is absolutely illegal to even possess in the United States, and that is eagle.
Eagle.
Eagle. Yeah, there are a number of flies like the golden eagle and the quilled eagle and so on and so forth that the only way you can possess eagle legally in this country is to be a Native American and to be able to prove your affiliation with your tribe, and otherwise anyone else who is not a Native American can be fined $20,000 and can spend time in jail just
wow.
for possessing. So the best substitute for eagle is dyed marabou.
Hmm. That's good to know. Yeah.
Yep. It is. It's what's used the most for a good substitute for eagle. So.
Okay.
I wanted to bring that up because I really want to caution people about that, because there are some feathers that you just don't want to.
Yeah, that was going to be a question I asked. Are there any others, not necessarily the United States, but ones that, as, you know, professional fly tiers, you just don't go there? I mean, even if they are available, that you shouldn't buy.
Heron is another good example. I know in the States that it's illegal to... Obviously, it's illegal to kill a heron in the wild because it is a protected species. I don't think that it has the restrictions that eagle has, but still, it's better to use a substitute for heron, and the best substitute are some of the brown-eared and blue-eared pheasants, because their feathers look exactly like heron, and if some of them might not be dark enough, but you can dye them, too. That's heron is probably the best other example I can think of.
Okay. What kind of leads us into, how do you find out about what these substitutes are? Is some of these did some of the vendors, are they a good source for
education
on this?
That's really your best. Well, vendors and also just talking to other salmon fly tires.
Are there an association of salmon fly tires or something that...
There are a few. I don't know about the East Coast, but up in the West Coast, up in the Northwest, there's the Northwest Salmon Fly Tires Guild, a tremendous group of people up there, men and women. I think they're up to about 60 now, and very, very strong group of salmon fly tires, and also they're really getting into hook making up there, salmon fly hooks. There's also a small group in Denver called the Katinga Club. I think they're still active. They don't have nearly as many members as the Northwest Guild does, but on the East Coast, I really don't know. I don't know if there are any real strong organizations like that.
Any,
a lot of individual tires, but
any. Yeah, and I know you promote getting a mentor of sorts, but that may be difficult for some people, you know, just getting started. But
yes,
is there any kind of forums out there on the Internet? Or,
you know,
the
fly tying forum. To be honest with you, I don't have time to get on the forums, but the fly tying forum, there is a section in the forum dedicated strictly to tying salmon flies, and I can send you the link to that, too, to put on, you know, on your site.
Okay.
That's a very, very good place. To ask people questions, find out about materials. There can sometimes be some, just as anything on the Internet, there can be some controversy that can crop up from time to time, but, you know, you can just ignore that because there's a lot of good information there. So.
Okay. Well, time to take another quick break, but when we come back,
we'll
talk with Mike more about tying the classic salmon fly. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please visit their website at www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. And view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about the Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Mike Rudensich about tying the classic salmon fly. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let me just check here. Let's see. We've got some questions coming in.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to deal with some of these, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a question. Dave in Tulsa, do you have any tips on selecting golden pheasant crests for tails, selecting individual feathers and whole crests that will provide good feathers?
Yeah, that's probably one of the best questions you can ask because, quite frankly, especially the tail, the golden pheasant tail that you'll use on the tail of your fly really defines the whole balance and shape of what the finished fly will be. And it's hard to describe it on the radio, but I always look for, well, there's two things. I look for a supplier who understands how to high grade golden pheasant crests. And by that, I mean selecting the very best. And when I talk about a crest, I'm talking about the entire head as opposed to the toppings. The toppings are the feathers that you pull from the crest. So we talk about a golden pheasant crest, we're talking about the head. So it's not just the selection of the head, but it's also how to prepare the toppings for tying. And there's been overworn technique, where a lot of tires will, to get the shape of the topping that they want, they will wet it, and then wrap it around, while it's still wet, wrap it around like a glass or something like that. Good salmon fly tires don't do that. We do not do that. What I do is when I get a crest, I pull the toppings from the crest, the longest toppings, and then I'll soak all those toppings for maybe an hour or an hour and a half. Then I'll take each topping out one by one with tweezers. And I forgot to mention that one other tool that's really important to have at your desk is a pair of fine tweezers. So I'll take each topping out one by one out of the water and then lay it on its side on a piece of glass. Oh, by the way, before I put on the glass, I kind of flick it, I guess you could say, to get any excess water off. I just, when I'm holding it with the tweezers, I just kind of flick it. Then I lay it on its side without changing or altering the shape, the original shape of the fly. And I put, the feather. Then I put all the toppings on that piece of glass, and then once they're completely dry, then I pull them off each one by one and run them through my finger, and then you'll end up with a perfect topping without a twisted rachis. And this technique straightens out any rachises that might be twisted or wavy.
Mm.
So that's how I prepare toppings. But it's really critical, really critical to find good toppings for the tail and for the wing.
We have another question here on the same subject. Mm-hmm. Pete Bates in Phoenix writes in, when crimping,
rachis? Yeah,
rachis.
After this question, I'll give you a real quick feather anatomy thing. So.
Okay. When crimping the rachis of golden pheasant crest, it often wants to roll and crimp, not in the direction I want. Can you share a technique to help him with that?
Well, yeah, crimping can mean more than one thing. I'm not sure what he means. I'm not sure what he means by crimping it. Usually when I think of crimping it is I determine where the tie-in point of the topping is going to be, and then I put, using my tweezers or my flat-nose pliers, I'll put them in the pliers at that point and then bend the topping upwards, and that defines the tying point. Crimping, he might mean that he's trying to shape the rachis of the feather to conform to his fly. And that's, again, that's really not a technique that I can describe. It's got to be, what I do is, especially at the front of the fly, sometimes I have a fly where the wing has a pretty pronounced curve. And if I tie in a topping that just without any preparation, it might tend to stick up, or we'd like to have the tip of the topping meet the tip of the tail. So I'll run the front of the rachis at the front of the fly over my thumbnail to kind of introduce a little bit more of a curve just right at that point. Maybe that's what he's talking about. I'm not really sure.
Okay. Let's see here. I notice you devoted a whole chapter quite extensively into dyeing materials.
I knew this was going to come up.
I suppose that, and that whole chapter looks like that could be a show in itself, at least. Is this something you do a lot, and is this something one needs to become proficient at?
Well, first of all, I have to apologize to anyone who's read my first book, especially that chapter, because the gentleman who put together that chapter for me is a chemist himself, so he understands very much how to work with some of these materials. But it's been a real difficult thing for anybody to replicate what he was able to do. What I do is I use Vineyard dyes, and Vineyards, I think they're still available. I've had dyes that I've had for about 20 years, but simply all you do is to prepare a dye bath, you get a saucepan or something like that and heat the water to just before it's boiling. You don't want to actually boil the water. Then you pour some of your dye into that, and again, it comes with experience to know how much. along with white vinegar. That's probably one of the most important ingredients you can pour in there as well. And then once you know that the dye itself has dissolved, I use a strainer. I put my feathers in the strainer and then dip the feathers with the strainer into the dye bath and let the feathers sit in there for a fairly long time, anywhere from 5 to 10 to 20 minutes, depending on how deep you want the color to be. I don't do a lot of dyeing, to be very honest with you, but it's not one of my favorite things to do, but it can work out fairly well if you do it the proper way. So I would seek out, anybody who really is into that, I would seek out a professional or someone who does that almost for a living and find out about that.
Yeah.
I hope that answers it. I don't do a lot of dyeing.
Okay.
No.
So it's not something that's really that.
It's not that critical. Yeah, because most of the materials you get are already dyed in all the colors you would want. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about hooks. What kind of hooks do you use? Is there a standard? And I noticed that you're doing some special things to these hooks in your book, so maybe you could talk about that as well.
Yeah, the standard, there are so many different kinds of hooks that you can actually use, but the size of the hook, generally speaking, that most tires use is a 5-aught hook, and I'm sorry now I didn't put one in front of me so I can actually tell you how long a hook like that is in inches. It's about 2 inches long, but all classic salmon fly irons, we like to call hooks irons, have a blind eye, meaning that you have to lash in a gut eye at the front. The hook just comes to a point. And there are some established hooks that you can buy. A Partridge of Redditch have salmon fly hooks that have been available for decades, and they're a nice hook. They're not really what you would call exhibition quality hooks, but they're good hooks. But there are a lot of hook makers out there now who are making very, very fine hooks for the salmon fly tire, and one gentleman who comes to mind right offhand is a gentleman named Ron Lucas. And he, again, I can, I'll send you the link to his site. He is probably one of the preeminent salmon fly hook makers right now in the country. They're not cheap. A 5-aught hook from Ron costs anywhere from $10 to $12. So they're not cheap, but they're very, very fine hooks. Now, I like to tie on anything from a 3-aught all the way up to an 8-aught hook. An 8-aught is a very large hook. Of 3 inches or so. So I'm trying to think what else I can talk about with regards to hooks.
Well, in your book, I think you show some manipulation of the hook.
Some fly tires do that, but actually these days you don't even have to go through that because there are so many hook makers out there now, so Ron Lucas being one of them, but The chapter in my first book shows how to reshape an existing, like a bass hook or whatever, to turn it into a classic salmon iron.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, if you want to get into that, that's a good place to start. But if you don't want to get into hook making, which I personally don't do myself, I just seek out good hook makers. So.
Do you have to, you mentioned exhibition quality hooks, so like the one source you had talked about, this gentleman making hooks. Out of the wrapping, is that ready to go? Do you have to paint it? Do you have to file it?
It's ready to go. No, it's
okay.
A hook like that is especially from what Ron does. The finish is on there. The shank is ground to a point. At the point of the hook, it's ready to tie. Once you get the hook, it's ready to go. So,
what's the reasoning for not having an eye on those hooks and having to tie in?
Well, back in the day when they were first made, they didn't have a way of a machine. All those hooks were made by hand. They were bent by hand. They were ground down by hand. They didn't have a way, or they just didn't even think about introducing an eye into the hook itself. So they, back then, up until about, oh, really, the turn of the 20th century, around 1900, when you start seeing eyed hooks, they would lash a length of gut loop, or gut, a silkworm gut, which is twisted, usually about three strands twisted together, and that gut then is, the gut loop is lashed to the hook all the way down to the point of the barb, and that's, that provided a way of lashing your fly casting line to the hook. And back then, that's the only way they could do it.
Interesting.
So we call them blind eye because they essentially didn't have an eye. So
yeah.
We tie them that way, and let me just say that we tie them that way nowadays because it's tradition.
George in Panton, Alabama, wrote in, and he says, why double hooks? He says, I see many classic flies with double hooks. Is this just an English-Scottish thing, or is there a reason behind that?
Well, it's funny he says that because I see very few, to be honest with you, I see very, very few classic sound patterns ever tied on double hooks. But that was not a standard type of hook that was used. I think some fishermen in the UK back then used them because they thought that it provided greater strength, because these fish that they were catching back then were 45 pounds and up, in Atlantic salmon. So they just, I would presume, I'm not an expert on that, but I presume that simply for the strength of the, of having two hooks instead of just the one. And back then, there are, in the new book that's coming out that I have, this, that we talked about earlier, the Classic Salmon Fly Patterns, there are actually two flies that employ two hooks, but the hooks are not tied or lashed together side by side. They're actually, you have the one hook, which is normal, then another hook is lashed to the top of it upside down, and then you you lash that hook to the bottom hook, and then you tie your materials on it that way. So. For catching big fish, very big
fish. Right. Pete wrote back in. He was the one asking about the crimping of the rakus. And he says, I was referring to crimping the tie-in point.
I personally never had trouble with it rolling or anything when I crimped it at the point. The important thing is that it's best to get your tying point as close to the end of the rakus as you can, where the rakus itself is kind of spongy or pithy. It's easier to crush that area than it is farther up the feather, because the feather, as you go farther into the rakus of the feather, it tends to be rounder, and also it actually becomes almost a triangular shape. So it's really hard to, it's almost impossible to crimp it up there. So it's best to crimp, find a topping that's long enough, just long enough to where you can make your tie-in point fairly close to the end of the rakus. And when I say the end, I mean the not the tip of the rakus, but the where what would have been in this, you know, the skin of the bird. So
okay. Another question, kind of going back a few minutes, Mike wrote in, speaking about substitutes, what about condor